All right, so I'm drained. I'm drained and I'm pulling one from the vault. But you know what? I think there's a lot of Friday content many of you have missed or don't remember. So I'm actually excited to reshare it with you. But here's what's going on. I really appreciate everybody's prayers. Laura's doing so much better. We got great news from the oncologist saying that they could identify very few cancer cells in the tumor mass. They were so optimistic about everything that they said Laura doesn't need chemotherapy or any drugs at all. Just do periodic MRIs, and if something happens, then start taking inhibitor drugs. But it's just been so much. Like, the night before we're going to go see the oncologist, our power went out, and it was 103 degrees here in Dallas. And so, you know, it's stress. I don't want Laura. And Laura, when she gets stressed, you know, is a risk of seizure. So I get out my phone. I find an Airbnb where I can put up our whole family and my wife's mom who's staying with us, and go and do that and get back and up during the night. And it's just a lot. But your prayers are really helpful. I really appreciate it. Our family's doing really well. And we really, really feel the support everyone's been giving. And I'm still trying to stick with it. I mean, if things get too heavy to bear, maybe I'll take a week or two off. We'll see. But I want to keep being able to serve all of you, our podcast listeners. So today I want to share with you an episode from The Vault. This is an episode I did back in 2018. So OG, original content, retro content for Council of Trent. This is back when I talked more about safety and disasters, which also I wanted to talk more about safety and disasters because I used to talk about that a lot and I haven't talked about that in a while. So maybe I'll find some new content on that. That'd be interesting. So enjoy this episode from The Vault. Please pray for us. And yeah, I hope you guys have a really great weekend. Blessed weekend.
Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
You know what day it is. It's Friday. It's the end of the week, which means here at Catholic Answers, it is Free for All Friday at the Council of Trent podcast. I am your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today on Free for All Friday, it's a little bit, what's the word I'm looking for? Gruesome, macabre, but interesting. So if you've listened to other previous podcasts, you know that I have an affinity for disaster. I've never been in a disaster myself. Praise be to God. You know, thank you, Lord. But I try to be prepared for them. And I'm also a student of history. I enjoy reading about history and understanding why the world is the way that it is. So I thought today it might be fun to talk about familiar things you see around you every day, things that are designed to actually keep you safe, but you don't realize it, or you take that for granted. You don't know, you know they keep you safe, but you may not know where they come from. So we're going to dive into that today. Before we do that, though, at the end of the week, I want to give a special thanks to our premium subscribers. You guys have been wonderful at keeping the podcast going and helping us with our expansion efforts. So if you're interested in helping the podcast out a bit more, you can visit trenthornpodcast.com for as low as $5 a month. Your donation can help us to be able to expand, reach into radio, do video hopefully soon. And also, you know, for yourself, you get access to great bonus content and even a nifty t-shirt if you're a $10 monthly supporter. And I love just having you here on the team here at the Council of Trent podcast. Check it out at trenthornpodcast.com. So these things you see around you, you might see the crash bar on a door. That a door doesn't have a doorknob. It has a bar that you push and swings outward. The smell of natural gas, that putrid smell. Even when you drive around and you see trucks have those bars on the bottom of them. Now, you may be able to think, oh, well, that's a safety feature to prevent X, Y, or Z from happening. And you would be right. But usually, when it comes to the world of safety and making the world a safer place, we have to often learn through mistakes and tragedies that befall other people. That's usually how it goes. No, it's rare people think, oh, this is something dangerous, especially 50, 100 years ago. People didn't think, this is actually dangerous. Maybe we should do this. Now, sometimes they did, but oftentimes there's an element they missed or there was an oversight, and that becomes glaringly obvious when something bad happens. So that's what we're going to talk about today, those things that you see around you, and you know why we have them and the purpose they serve and where they came from. So I'm going to talk about five things today, five everyday devices, and the unfamiliar disasters you may not have heard about that brought them to us. So the first one is called the crash bar. You probably see this here at Catholic Answers office that the doors leading, you know, the doors to our offices have door knobs, but the doors that are the exits to the building, they swing outward and they have a bar that you just push to open the door. You've probably seen that everywhere you go. You know, you go to a department store, grocery, you know, grocery store. I mean, you have the sliding doors, but usually even next to them, you have doors that push out. Why do we have that? Well, it's to allow people to be able to exit the building quickly in case there's an emergency and not become trapped inside, which is what happened at two tragedies that occurred, one at the in 1883 and the other in England and the other in the early part of the 20th century. The first one is called the Victoria Hall Stampede. This occurred in Sunderland, England on June 16th in 1883. There was a large concert hall there in Sunderland, and there were a bunch of children there to hear a variety show. It was a show being put on by traveling entertainers named Mr. and Mrs. Fay. And there were, I think there was something like 1,000 children, over 1,000 children in the audience in this big hall. And the entertainers promised them that at the end of the show, they would all get free prizes or free gifts. So all the kids just jumped out of their seats and started to run out of the theater. And there was one door that at the entrance of the theater for them to come in. And so they were all running down a hallway, down steps to this door to get outside to get their prizes. Now, here's the problem. The door opened inward, and it was a bolted door. It didn't open very wide. And some reasons for this are believed so that children wouldn't sneak in or rush past in to make sure that they would pay. And that, you know, they'd sneak in. So the door, it opened inward at the end of this narrow stairwell going down. So you have hundreds of kids running down, and then they block at the door. And so the door, you know, is shut by the pressure of everyone on the other side because it opens inward, not outward. And then what happened is the students all began to asphyxiate and to be crushed in this stampede. One of the survivors, William Codling Jr., this is an account that he gives. He was there in 1894. He later talked about what happened. He was one of the kids there. He said, "Soon we were most uncomfortably packed, but still going down. Suddenly I felt that I was treading upon someone lying on the stairs, and I cried in horror to those behind, 'Keep back, keep back. There's someone down.' It was no use. I passed slowly over and onwards with the mass. Before long, I passed over others without emotion." And so I think about 183 children died in what ended up being a stampede. I think someone later came along and was able to open the door from the outside, take it off its hinges, and get the kids out of there. But that's what happened. And so that, from the Victoria Hall stampede, the British government put forward efforts to develop regulation that required doors to open outward, not inward, as major exits to buildings, and for the door to have a crash bar, because it doesn't do any good if the door opens outward, but there's a knob that's like obscured or like is blocked by people, and you're not able to get the door open easily. So to get people out, just have one horizontal bar. It's like, it's called a panic bar or a crash bar. To open the door that swings outward, it's easy just to get out. Now, not everyone learned those lessons. In America, we had to learn that lesson the hard way as well. In 1903, December 30th, 1903, in Chicago, Illinois, was the Iroquois Theater fire. This is the deadliest single building fire in United States history. It was even deadlier than the Great Chicago Fire that took place, I think, back in like 1878. It took place, you know, 30 years earlier. The fire that basically burned down the city of Chicago did not kill as many people as this single building fire at Iroquois Theater on December 30th, 1903. So what happens, the fire took place around 3:15 p.m. It was ignited. There were curtains backstage that were ignited by a broken arc light. And so the theater was putting on a performance of Mr. Bluebeard. And the actors were on stage getting ready to perform. And when you read about Iroquois Theater, it is kind of like the Titanic of theater fires, that people there were other theater fires before this. People were very concerned about fire safety. So the theater advertised that the Iroquois Theater was fireproof, like the unsinkable Titanic. And they said, well, we have these safety measures. We have an asbestos curtain. And I've been in theaters before that still have this, where if there's a fire backstage, you can pull a handle or pull a ring, and a curtain lined with fireproof asbestos will clink, 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 go down, and it will separate the backstage area from the lobby or the auditorium to protect people so they can get away in case, because the thing most likely to cause a fire in a theater are the lights that are on the stage, these very hot lights that are going to ignite curtains or drapery. That's what happened to Iroquois Theater. And they had, you know, fire extinguishers, things like that. But later, actually, but it turned out the fire warden in charge said, no, it wasn't fireproof. And there was a lot of corruption. If they were going to report that there were fire hazards, the fire warden would just get fired for this, that they said, well, we're not going to deal with that. The features that they had. So when the fire began, the fire extinguishers didn't work. They didn't work at all. Well, I mean, they weren't traditional extinguishers like we have today. They were just basically tubes filled with baking soda, and you'd push a handle and the baking soda would come out, but they couldn't get the fire extinguisher to go high enough to reach the fire that was happening backstage. And then the asbestos curtain, one, it wasn't even really fireproof. It jammed midway through. So the fire and the smoke was able to enter into the auditorium. There were no exit lights. There were no marked exit doors. There were ornamental windows that were made to look like doors. So 200 people went down a hallway. They thought it was a door at the end, but it was an ornamental window that didn't open. And so they were trapped. Other people, there were iron gates that didn't open because, you know, they couldn't get the locks open on the doors or the gates open. And 600 people ended up dying. And that instituted in the U.S. to say, no, we have to have these safety features. You have to have doors that open outward that are clearly marked and doors that don't have these complicated locks on them. One person was able to open this complicated lock. It was like a Bazile lock. I can't remember the name of it, at Iroquois Theater, because he had a similar lock at home. In his ice box. Other people were rescued. There was a door that opened inwards that people were jamming. A railroad worker was walking by. He had tools on him. He went, took the hinges off the door, and then the door, you know, fell over and people were able to run out of the theater, and he saved a lot of lives that day. So it was these tragedies that gave us the universal prescription to have panic bars on doors and to make sure they swing outwards. Now, this lesson wasn't learned, I think, 40 years later. It was like 1942 in New York. I think it was New York. It was at the Coconut Grove fire. This is a nightclub that a lot of people died at because, once again, you didn't have marked exits. You had locked exits, so people are worried you're going to dine and dash. You had doors that open inwards. You had a revolving. I think this was the club where you had the revolving door. And people got stuck and jammed in the revolving door. They couldn't get out. So now even buildings that have the revolving door, you'll notice on the sides for safety, there are regular doors that open outward that have crash bars in case there's an emergency. All right, the next one. Why does natural gas smell? Natural gas is odorless. It's an odorless compound used for heating, fuel, things like that. Why does it smell? Well, we add a substance to it so it smells like rotten eggs. Now, you're going to tell me, well, duh, Trent, it smells so you can detect a gas leak. And you would be right. That's correct. But that's a lesson that had to be learned the hard way in what has now become the deadliest school disaster in American history. This is the New London School Explosion. It was on March 18th, 1937, in New London, Texas. There was a natural gas leak at the New London School, and it occurred, I think, at around like 3:17 p.m., sometime between 3:05 and 3:20. I think it was at 3:05, right before school was going to let out. There was a natural gas leak in the basement. No, it was at 3:17. Limmy Butler turned on an electric sander. He was one of the employees at the school. The school was getting natural gas from a nearby oil field. So there was a lot of oil production nearby here in Texas. And so to save costs, the school, instead of using steam heating, used gas heating. And they just ran a line to one of the oil wells, and they got this what's called wet gas. It was a byproduct of the oil production that was gas that they couldn't really use for anything. So they used it for heating in the school, but it was called wet gas or untreated gas. It didn't have any odor added to it, so you couldn't smell if there was a leak. So there was a leak this day. It filled up the basement and the hollow area underneath the school, filled up the whole thing. And then at 3:17, Butler turns on an electric sander that causes a spark. It ignites the gas, and the building exploded with such force. The roof was lifted off. It crashed back down. A two-ton concrete block, something weighs 2 tons, which is more than like a car weighs, was thrown 200 feet and crushed a car in the parking lot, you know, parked 200 feet away. And everyone heard the explosion for miles around. Parents rushed in. Workers from the nearby oil rigs, the roughnecks, came with acetylene torches and equipment to try to get through the concrete and the metal and free and save as many children as they could. There ended up being about 300 students were killed and about 300 students experienced non-fatal injuries, but many of them being quite serious. And the outcry that came after this event helped people to see the dangers of using wet gas or untreated gas, and mandated that natural gas that's used for heating in homes, residences, businesses had to be treated so that it has that notifiable scent to it. It has that kind of rotten egg scent that you can smell and detect if there is a gas leak, and then you can be able to be able to evacuate the building. So I think later or after the disaster, this was done in the Texas Engineering Practice Act, and then later other municipalities and cities adopted it as well. Number three. Why are airplane windows round? I mean, it sounds like a dumb question, right? You know, well, have you ever asked that? I mean, think about it. The window in your office, the window in your house isn't round. It's square. Most windows in buildings are square. The windows in our car, I mean, they're kind of rounded at the edges, but even if they were square, you know, older cars are square. It's not that big a deal. Why are they round on airplanes? Well, they're round on airplanes after the tragedies that occur with the de Havilland Comet jet. So in 1952, the Havilland Comet was introduced. It was one of the first jet airplanes. It was operated by British Overseas Airways Corporation. And so the Comet revolutionized air travel. Even Queen Elizabeth used it. If you ever watched The Crown, great show. They also do a great episode about it, the Great Smog in England, another interesting disaster we'll have to talk about. That was in the 50s. But in 1950s, in there, Queen Elizabeth travels to Africa, goes around the world in her jet. Just for her. And so the Comet, you know, revolutionized air travel. Instead of using noisy propellers, you could use jets, you had greater range. But then a few years later, one of the Comets was taking off from Rome's Ciampino Airport, and it exploded 20 minutes after takeoff. And people couldn't figure out why, you know, what went wrong with the plane. And then it happened again to another plane. And they realized when they looked at the injuries of the passengers, they had ruptured lungs, they had the fuselage tore apart. There was an explosive decompression. They realized that the Comet, because it had square windows, that contributed to more metal stress fractures. So when you have a square window, there is more stress at the corners. So there's an intensified amount of stress at the corners of the window. It's not evenly distributed. Whereas if you have an oval or a circular window, like on a submarine, a porthole is going to be a circle because there's a lot of, you know, I don't think submarines, you know, don't have windows. The only submarine I guess I'm talking about is the one at Disneyland for the Finding Nemo ride. But portholes, like on ships, the ones that are below the waterline, they're going to be circles or ovals because it distributes the stress between the glass and the metal better. And so that's what happened with the Comet, that they realized that the windows, the plane was more likely to break up if there was metal fatigue or if there was a problem by these stress fractures at the corner points of the windows. So that is what happened. The Comet was eventually taken out of service, but later jetliners that were introduced adopted the oval window design. Also, a little tidbit, you notice on the window of your airplane, because I travel in airplanes all the time, there's a little hole. You ever wonder about that? On the airplane, there's a little hole at the bottom of the window. What is that for? It's to wick away moisture. The window is not like, you know, it's not like a glass plane or anything. It's I think it's like strengthened plexiglass, but it's dual pane. There's a gap in between there. And that hole allows to wick away moisture so that condensate, nothing fogs the glass. So it is there to improve visibility. And I will tell you what I love in the new generation of airliners, because I'm flying all the time, the 787 Dreamliner. I took that thing from San Francisco to Tel Aviv, 14-hour flight. They have windows that during the flight you can look, if you're sitting next to it, you can look at it and see things, but they change color. Like they can become dark blue. So if you're flying, and even if it's light outside, if your biological clock says you should be sleeping right now, the window is tinted like dark blue. So it keeps the cabin all nice and you can still get your nappies in. Not that I can sleep on a plane. I can't. Ugh. I envy those people who can sleep on flights. I can't. So when I get to a place like Perth, Australia, and I've been up for 30 hours, I'm kind of a basket case. I gotta go get my lemon lime bitters, get a cheeseburger, and then pass out for about 12 hours. But that's why, that is why you know more about airplane windows. Number four, the Mansfield Bar. What is the Mansfield Bar? Well, have you ever driven by a semi, behind a semi, and you notice that the end of the trailer, underneath the back of the trailer, there's a bar. What is that bar for? Now, if you thought in a kind of morbid and grotesque way, you might think, oh, that's if I rear-end him, I'm going to hit the bar and not have the trailer come in and hit me. Because if the engine block, if the bumper of my car hits that metal bar on the back of the semi, well, at least the only thing that's going to crumple is the front part of my car, the crumple zone of my car, and I should be okay. If that bar were not there, the engine block of my car, the bumper, is going to go under the tractor trailer, and the back of the tractor trailer, the first thing it's going to hit is my windshield and me. And this lesson was learned with the death of actress Jane Mansfield in 1967. So Jane Mansfield was a blonde bombshell, would be the term that was used. She's a sex symbol from the 1950s, you know, compared to Marilyn Monroe. There's a very famous photo. If you don't remember her, there's a very famous photograph of her at a party for Sophia Loren. And Mansfield is a very well-endowed woman. And she's wearing an extremely low-cut dress, and she's smiling at the camera, and Sophia Loren is giving her the most amazing passive-aggressive glare at Mansfield for wearing such a low-cut dress. So you've probably seen that picture. That's Jane Mansfield. She died at the age of 34. She was making an appearance at Gus Stevens Supper Club in Biloxi, Mississippi. She was then driven by her attorney, Sam Brody. They had a driver, Ronnie Harrison. In the car was Sam Brody, her attorney. Ronnie Harrison was a driver. She was there. And three of her children, Miklos, Zoltan, and Mariska. And they were driving. And where they were driving, there was a tractor trailer that was slowed behind another truck that was spraying mosquito fog. You know, it's an insecticide. So there was a lot of fog in the air. You couldn't see the tractor trailer. It was obscured. And at 2:25 a.m. in the morning, the car with Mansfield in it collided with this tractor trailer, and it instantly killed the three adults, Mansfield, Brody, and Harrison. Now, Mansfield, contrary to popular reports, was not decapitated, but she did die from extensive skull fracture, cranial injury. I mean, it was, you know, they were just killed instantly. Amazingly, the three children escaped with minor injuries, Miklos, Zoltan, and Mariska. Mariska actually still does acting today. If you watch Law & Order SVU, Mariska is Mariska Hargitay. She plays Olivia Benson on Law & Order SVU. Her mom was Jane Mansfield, and she still has a scar to this day from the injury. I think she was only like 3 years old when this happened, when her mom died. And she was in this accident. But afterwards, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration encouraged the trucking industry to adopt this kind of ICC bar, or what has now become known as the Mansfield Bar, named in honor of, but named after what happened to Jane Mansfield. And finally, when you open a drug at the store, like a Tylenol, Advil, there's tamper technology. It says, you know, do not open if seal is broken. There's a little, you know, like paper cover on the pill bottle. And if you pop it open, it's like you feel a little air rushing out. Why do we have that? Well, my wife said, well, to keep people from tampering, you know, keep people from messing with it. You're right. But we didn't always have that. What brought that about were something, once again, more to scare the living daylights out of you, the Chicago 1982 Tylenol murders. You may not have heard about this, but in September 29th, September 30th, somebody in Chicago went around, bought Tylenol from the store, opened it up, took the capsules home. These were the capsules you could unscrew, and he put cyanide in them, went back to the store, put the bottle back on the shelves, and people bought it. The first victim was 12-year-old Mary Kellerman, who died after taking an extra-strength Tylenol. They found cyanide in her system. Later, Adam Janis died, and they noticed these people all took Tylenol, all had cyanide poisoning. And so the police had to drive around with loudspeakers saying, don't use Tylenol, don't go to the store. They did an investigation. They realized it wasn't on the pharmaceutical end or the factory end. It happened in the stores. Someone was taking this and tampering with it. So Johnson & Johnson actually responded in a very positive way and a assertive way to say, we are not going to tolerate this. We're implementing changes to drug manufacturing. And they introduced the anti-tamper technology. And so that is why in drugs and other substances, you have seals and other devices to see whether it was tampered. Now, here's the thing about the Chicago Tylenol murders. It's unsolved. We still don't know to this day who did this. There was a guy in New York, James William Lewis, who was arrested. So because he was arrested on extortion, he demanded $1 million from Johnson & Johnson saying, pay me $1 million or I'm going to keep doing this. They think, though, he was just trying to make money, that he lived in New York at the time, that he was not the one who was doing this. An interesting theory, though, of who could have done it, someone who was living there at the time, who later went on to do kind of violent things. He lived there from 1978 to 1982, Ted Kaczynski, a.k.a. the Unabomber, even though the Unabomber claims he never worked with Cyanide before he, I think he was executed a few years ago. That's a thought, but otherwise one of those unsolved mysteries. But one thing that is not a mystery anymore is your knowledge about these aspects of our daily life, things that keep us safe. So, hey, I had fun Free For All Friday. I hope you learned a thing or two, and I hope you keep listening to the podcast. I'm grateful for you all, and I hope that you all have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.